Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we welcomed Michael Wong, MD, to discuss the implications for the full FDA approval of Brexucel for the treatment of adult patients with relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma. On April 2, 2026, the FDA granted traditional approval to Brexucel based on data from the Phase 2 ZUMA-2 trial, with confirmatory data from Cohort 3 showing that patients naive to a BTK inhibitor experienced an overall response rate of 91%, a complete response rate of 79%, and a median duration of response that was not reached. Dr. Wong detailed the evolution of therapies in the MCL treatment paradigm, leading up to the approval of Brexucel and the integration of CAR T-cell therapy. Along with highlighting the evolution of MCL management, Dr. Wong explained how data from Cohort 3 of the ZUMA-2 trial add further context to the role of CAR T-cell therapy in the treatment paradigm and how it may affect treatment sequencing considerations.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Wong. I'm a Putin Clark Endowed Professor in the Department of Lymphoma and Myeloma at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, Texas. On April 2026, the FDA, US FDA, granted full approval for brepocitinib autoleucel to treat relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma is relatively a rare lymphoma, accounting about 6% of the non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And in the US, yearly is about 4,000 cases per year. But because the patients live longer, their prevalence are increased. If you think there's 20 to 40,000 people live within the US, you think about the world. The Europeans have a higher incidence of mantle cell lymphoma, and Asia have less percentage, but they have more people. So if you calculate the global need for to treat mantle cell lymphoma, there's a humongous amount of patients we're talking about. So, but the US FDA full approval usually trickles down to full approval by other agencies in Europe and Asia and South American, North American countries. So this is very, very meaningful. So what made FDA give such a full approval? And let me start with the background of lymphoma therapy for mantle cell lymphoma. 26 years ago, when I joined MD Anderson, and within the same walls, we deliver chemotherapies to patients with newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma. For young patients, we use the highest dose chemotherapy, so high that we have to preserve their stem cells and give them and use stem cells after the high dose chemotherapy to rescue them. And we also had developed hyper-CVAD, the highest chemotherapy you can deliver to a human without a stem cell support. So, of course, the patient has acute toxicities. They may die from gram sepsis. They also have a lot of underreported secondary malignancies, very high. So for older patients, we keep using R-CHOP therapy, R-beta-mastin therapy. Those are not curable, lasting only about 2 or 3 years, and relapse of mantle cell lymphoma is not curable. So, and then, we began with the first targeted therapy called bortezomib. Bortezomib is a target for proteasome, and it has a response rate of 32%. 32%, think about it. You give a patient a drug, only 1/3 of the time the patient would have a benefit. You know, out of desperation, we didn't have anything else. We proved it Velcade. We all, delayed it Velcade, bortezomib. And then we have the new drug called lenalidomide, rather than bortezomib, which is given intravenously and subcutaneously, lenalidomide was a pill. But the lenalidomide, the response rate was only 25%. When I studied the R2 therapy, I used lenalidomide, rituximab, the relapse setting was 57%. So nevertheless, because of lack of anything better, lenalidomide was also proved with its inferior response rate. The real breakthrough, but people argue whether bortezomib or lenalidomide are pure chemo-free agents because they both cause cytopenias, especially thrombocytopenias, that they, especially lenalidomide, can in randomized trials cause significant increase in secondary malignancies. So people often call this semi-chemotherapy or semi-chemo-free therapies. The real break chemo-free therapy broke in was in 2013, FDA approved ibrutinib, which is a BTK inhibitor, oral therapy that we don't need. Before that, chemotherapy with all the patients are bald without hair. They're pale because of the anemia, and they have big catheter dangling because they need the big catheter to infuse the chemotherapy drugs, and catheter-related infections are very common. But all of a sudden, there's an oral agent, which is the response rate of 68% single agent, rather than the five drug combinations that require a big catheter, require the low blood counts, cause nausea, vomiting, cause lost hair, and sometimes you have to deliver those chemotherapies in the hospital, such as hyper-CVAD. So when I presented the ibrutinib therapy in the 15 minutes, there were three standing ovations that really everybody was so excited that brought in the ibrutinib was the first approved in MCL before it approved for other indications such as CLL, marginal lymphoma, and GVHD. But ibrutinib was proven to be a toxicity because of off-target effects in a phase three clinical trial called SHINE, and I led and with my colleagues, the ibrutinib separate the PFS by far, but the overall survival are overlapping between the placebo and ibrutinib arms. Because of that toxicity issue, ibrutinib was withdrawn from the US FDA. In 2017, a secondary CAR T cell, secondary BTK called acalabrutinib was approved, and this is much better in terms of cardiotoxicity, but still have toxicities in infections and so forth. And in 2019, there's a zanubrutinib approved. But after I had the pleasure of leading the ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib was led by Dr. Song from Beijing Tumor Hospital. So people, we use BTK inhibitors, single agents, combinations. We find whichever patient who are refractory to BTK or relapsed after the BTK inhibitors, their survival is only less than a year. So that's created an urgent unmet clinical need. And then the CAR T cell therapy, which was designed to overcome BTK resistance, the first CAR T therapy ever approved was the ZUMA-2 CAR T cell therapy with breast converting autoleucel, which is the CD19 autologous CAR T cell. And there are three cohorts in the ZUMA-2 clinical trial. The first cohort, which was the FDA-based approval-based from cohort 60 patients with 74 patients evaluable for toxicity and 60 for efficacy. And the overall response rate at that time was 87% with a CR was 62%. And it was toxic. You know, the CRS, grade 3 or 4 toxicities was 15%. And the grade 3 or 4 higher CR ICANS was 32%. Okay, but nevertheless, with a longer follow-up time, those people with the population with has less than 1 year live. And after 5 years, we found out the breast covered autoleucel associated with the overall survival about 46, 48 months. So quadruple the survival of the patients. Really, really meaningful. But the cohort 1 have used 2 million infusion of the CAR T cells, 2 million cells. But they initially tried to design the study, and we wanted to be safe, so we opened another cohort with 4 times less CAR T cell infused, with 0.5 million cells. Why? Because we are afraid if cohort 1 is too toxic, we can fall in fact in cohort 2. But with cohort 2 enrolled 14 patients, also BTK exposed, but there was no difference between cohort 1 and cohort 2. cohort, the same efficacy, same toxicity, not any better efficacy, not any better efficacy, or not less toxicity. Therefore, cohort two was stopped because we chose to enroll in the cohort one with 2 million cells. Eventually, showed good efficacy and balanced the toxicity, led to FDA approval in 2020. But it was a provisional approval, was an accelerated approval, not full approval. So SUMMER 2 have three cohorts. The first two cohort, 2 million cells, 0.1 million cells, they all in prior BTK exposed patients. And they have all together 82 patients. But the third cohort has 86 patients. And the third cohort, the difference between third cohort and the first two cohorts is that the first two cohorts enrolled BTK treated patients, but the third cohort, 86 patients, it was BTK naive. They have never received prior BTK in therapy, otherwise they will not be eligible for the protocol. So with the 86 patients, the overall response rate was 91%, CR was 79%, and the toxicity was balanced. So with the cohort, if you put cohort one, cohort two, and cohort three patients all together, there's 160 some patients, and their overall response rate is still very high, CR is very high, and the CRS was overall grade three or four was 12%. ICANS grade three about 33%. Infections also grade three or higher, 33%. So this really proves that not only we have 5-year data in some cohorts, but also we have another 86 patients, which is even more patients than the first two patients combined, cohort combined. So the FDA finally is convinced that this is really a good therapy that can have delivered good efficacy with good overall survival, long-term follow-up data. They decided to fully approve the FDA. Okay, now then, how about the toxicity management, right? So a lot of people think that the community doctors do not have the means to do the deal with the CAR T-cell toxicities acutely, and I still agree with that. Because most of the CAR T-cell, almost all the CAR T-cells are infused with the CAR T-cell centers. They're usually a tertiary center approved by all the authorities to be able to carry out the infusion and deal with the toxicities. The acute toxicities is CRS and ICANS, what we call neurotoxicity. The CRS occurs usually average on about 4 days after CAR T-cell infusion. It lasts about 7 days. So within like 2 weeks, CAR T-cell come and gone. So CAR T, the CRS, the, I'm sorry, not CAR T-cell, CRS come and gone. And not only, and also the ICANS usually occurs on day six, but it lasting can last for 19 days. So within a month, this the most life-threatening CRS of ICANS has much dealt with mainly by all tertiary centers. And when the patient are released in the community, is after the first scan, should have complete remission at day 28 or day 30, then the patient go to the CAR. So, but because many years has passed, we have grown our knowledge, we have found new therapies for the CRS and neurotoxicity. Those are no longer as life-threatening as in the beginning, because all these years of our skills, our knowledge, and also mainly because they are dealt with in the tertiary centers, academic centers. But when the patient released in the community, infection comes in. Because we have gained so much efficacy, skills in effectively managing CRS and neurotoxicity, the most life-threatening side effect of the CAR T is infections. And infections are managed by the CAR T cell, provided the community oncologist or hematologist. So infections, sometimes we only see textbooks like Aspergillus, histoplasmosis, Aspergillus in the brain, JC virus, even the West Nile virus are found in the post-CAR T cell patients. Those are usually, we studied this 30 years ago in medicine. We never see a case. All of a sudden, because of profound CAR T cell therapy. First of all the CAR T, the before the breast covered in autoleucel, three chemotherapies or target therapy was given. And then during the CAR T therapies, CD19 is a B cell marker. You deplete it, causing B cell aplasia. That means there's no less B cells to produce antibodies to fight infections. All these weird infections will come up, right? So because of the profound infection risk, so community doctors need to know. But the number one killer in CAR T cell therapy are those post-CAR T infections. Number one, I would recommend all the community doctors to check the immunoglobulin G, IgG. If they are low, please infuse IVIG. This has been proven to be very effective to preventing bad infections. And also screen diligently by any signs of infection that kill them while they are very small. So the infections are, for example, you have the patient sinusitis. In the CAR T cell patient, more than one-third of patients that the sinusitis creeping into the lung become pneumonia and become life-threatening. So you must pay attention to the sinus. Not only you give them the antibiotics, you make sure their IVIG is giving if IgG is low, and then you also need to give them to make sure you revert to the after you dealt with everything you can do. You also need to tell the patient to to wash the sinuses with the apparatus called nebulizer, which has a motor screwed in one and come out of the other nostril. So you need to pay attention to the details. Not only that, if the patient with the aging, their septum might be deviated, blocking the sinuses. So therefore, your infection can never be cleared by all the above. You have to have the ENT doctor to correct the infrastructure abnormality. So this is very important. Make sure you refer the sinus patient who have recurrent sinus to the ENT doctor to make sure their structure are normal. This is only about, but other infections like the UTI, if you are not able to clear the UTI, the IgG has been supplemented with IVIG, you need to refer the patient to the ID doctors for them to figure out whether with or without cultures, how to eradicate the UTI. This is only, and you need to also the post-CAR T, all the infection risk goes up, especially COVID-19 risk goes up, higher incidence, higher mortality. So you need to find, screen all of the viruses, and make sure you find that COVID-19, now we have numerous therapies to treat COVID-19. This is for the, well, other people say, well, Dr. Wang, not everybody can get the CAR T cell therapy. So I think if I remember correctly, 2 years ago, the data is like only 20 to 30% of patients who are eligible to get the CAR T cell therapy, only 20% get the therapy. This is bad. In the Chinese history, philosophy, literature, there's the classified doctors, the three types. The top doctor, number one class of doctors are those who can change improve the policy, make the country rich and a good economy so that more money are spent on healthcare to make the drug available, especially for life-saving therapies like breast cabaretin or autoleucel. So those people who are not able to implement the policy, they know the disease. They can the second class of doctors are those who are able to prevent the disease before they occur. Obviously, that's the best prevention is also very important. I belong to the third class, those when the disease happens, we didn't have enough money to improve the overall of the nation of the health. We didn't have good healthcare policies, and we are not able to instill measures to prevent the disease. So when the disease happens, that we have to treat the disease as it is. I belong to the third class of doctors. I'm not able to solve that with the medicine alone. I'm not able to assess solve the assess access to the best therapies. Medicine is an economy, social, medical model. So medicine alone is not enough. You have to have the social as a country, and you have to have other policies. So I leave those to our able leaders of the world to make, put more money accessible to healthcare so that we could see more patients. And thank you for listening to me.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.